This is Functional Medicine Update for December 1997, Volume 16, Number 12. Our final edition for 1997 will focus on the general subject of premature age-related diseases. On Side 1, we will include reports on mitochondrial function and age-related disease, biochemistry and energy transport, blood diseases as a marker of molecular dysfunction, the risks of acetaminophen use, and hepatic encephalopathy. On Side 2 of this issue, our clinician interview will be with cardiovascular surgeon Dr. Morrison Bethea. We'll conclude this issue with additional reports on premature age-related diseases, including DHEA and cortisol and disease, chromium and glucose tolerance factor, omega-3 versus long-chain fatty acids, the DASH study, and finally, age-related macular degeneration. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the December 1997 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
By this time, you should have received the postcard that announces our fifth International Symposium on Functional Medicine, and I just wanted to give you a heads up and alert. I know that we're all setting our schedules for the 1998 season, and we're very excited about the fifth International Symposium, which is being held May 2nd through 7th, 1998, at the beautiful Orchid Resort on the Big Island of Hawaii. This is on the Kohala Coast. I think you would not find a more beautiful setting than the setting for our fifth International Symposium. And I don't think you'll find a much more interesting focus of topic or presenters either. This is going to be a very unique meeting. The topic heading is Functional Medicine Applications to Disorders of Gene Expression. The three principal days of the symposium will deal with things like homocysteine, inflammation, and modifying coronary heart disease, arthritis, and dementia. The second day dealing with nutrient modulation of adverse side effects of drugs. And the third day, nutrient modulation of cancer genes. We've got some very stellar plenary presenters who are at the forefront of research and clinical application in those topic areas, and then some good workshops, breakout sections to really get down, roll up sleeves, and start integrating these concepts into effective clinical practice. So I hope that you've got your calendar set for May 1998 and will be with us at the 5th International Symposium on Functional Medicine. Over the next few months, you'll be hearing more about the topic areas as we start to prime you for the May meeting, and I would have your ears alertened to the fact that this will be part of the focus that we have in our Functional Medicine Update preparation. Well, what about this month, December, as we finish out the 1997 year? What can we kind of give you in a retrospective review and in a prospective excitement for the next year and where it can make a significant difference in improving patient outcomes? Well, this month, I really want to focus on a theme, and I think you'll hear it through our Clinician of the Month and through it the various clinical applications that we're going to describe from recently published literature. And the theme is that one can modulate the aspects of premature age-related diseases by recognizing certain functional risk factors that are not necessarily the accepted cardiovascular risk factors to disease, but rather extend beyond this to other functional aspects of cellular physiology and interrelationships of different organ systems in this web-like pattern that we've been describing in previous issues of FMU, to give rise then to individualized patterns of health or age-related risk factors, which then can be modified. So we're talking about modifiable factors by asking the right questions, getting different answers. This month we're going to focus on some of those modifiable areas and try to bring it down into clinically meaningful application. The first will be looking at some of the mitochondrial DNA relationships to dysfunction as a central thought in functional medicine that's emerging from the literature. Second, we'll be looking at the molecular medicine modification of these risks, utilizing what Dr. Linus Pauling and Dr. Roger Williams talked about many years ago as the molecular milieu, trying to adjust this in the cell so as to promote better function and reduce the risk to even a genetically encoded disease. And the one we're going to focus on this month, just as an example, is pathogenesis of the red cell, looking at thalassemias and sickle cell disorders as a model, which I think is quite interesting. Then next we will move on to looking at adverse reactions to the environment. This could be things like drug adverse reactions, and then moving on from that to endotoxicity-related reactions. with specific emphasis on chronic fatigue syndrome, and then lastly, some age-related phenomena related to dysglycemia, or the poor management of blood sugar and insulin levels. So that ought to be a fairly robust series of topics to focus our energies on in this month's Functional Medicine Update. So let's start off looking a little bit at this mitochondrion, the seat of the energy production within cells. I think the clinical symptom of fatigue and pain, which are the two symptoms that often bring patients to the offices of health providers, are interesting in their origin, and we can look at them at whole organism problems of functional disability, or we can look at them going down again to organ systems, organs and tissues, and finally into the cells and the subcellular milieu. What is the origin of fatigue and pain? And of course, the answer we would get immediately to that is both of those conditions are symptoms of a high level that relate to a myriad of interacting messenger substances and cell physiological dysfunctions that ultimately give rise to fatigue and pain. So we can't pinpoint a specific cause. We can't say the CPT code or the diagnostic code for fatigue and pain is blank and then fill in the blank with a single explanation. What we can say, however, is that there is an emerging view that many of these conditions that associate themselves with fatigue and pain are a consequence of alterations in mitochondrial function and energy transport. If the mitochondrion is the organelle within the cell that is the responsible site for energy production and transmission, then the root origin of some of the problems can be traced back to mitochondrial dysfunction. Interestingly enough, as molecular techniques have improved in their precision and power, we've started to see people start looking at mitochondrial DNA as a record of linkage to a person's past genetic history. Recall, if you would, that the mitochondrion is the only place within the cell that is known to contain genetic material, polydeoxyribonucleic acid, DNA, that is outside of the cell nucleus and the traditional chromosomes. Presumably, this mitochondrial DNA, which is very different in its form than nuclear DNA, it's circular, it's not bound up with histone and non-histone proteins, and therefore it's very exposed to oxidant stress, and it doesn't have the coats of protection that does nuclear DNA. So it, according to Dr. Bruce Ames at the University of California, Berkeley, is about 2,000 times more susceptible to oxidative damage than is nuclear DNA, and that would mean mutagenic chromosomal, or in this case genetic damage to mitochondrial DNA. The mitochondrial DNA is also interesting in that it comes almost exclusively from the mother, in that the ovum has lots of large mitochondria, the sperm mitochondria all on the tail that falls off upon fertilization. Therefore, our biochemical energy process is determined by mitochondrial DNA comes from our mothers. We are more than 50% our mothers in inheritance. That was a kind of a rude awakening for men who felt that they were equal contributors to the genetics of the offspring. And secondly, it's interesting to note that with the mitochondrial DNA, because it has this more, quote, primitive, end quote, configuration than that of nuclear DNA in the chromosomes, it resembles very closely a bacteria genetic DNA structure. And this seems to support the view that many people have proposed, that mitochondria represent protists that some millennia ago, millions and millions of years ago, swam inside a eukaryotic nucleated cell to find a little friendly environment. This would be like infection, in other words, and in so doing, lived symbiotically in concert with that eukaryotic cell ever since. So our mitochondria basically are bacterial-like co-inhabitants. And in fact, the mitochondrial DNA structure of the mitochondrion cells vary from one mitochondria to another, indicating that we may have been infected in our past with different bacteria, all of which have lived and been passed on by transferring their own bacterial DNA genome onto the subsequent daughter cells. So it's kind of an interesting concept, isn't it, to view our biochemical energy, the oxidative phosphorylation machinery, to have a long evolutionary history traced back to an infection with a specific bacterium or bacteria, which then bring their genetic messages to the host cell. Well, recently in the journal Cell, a German-American team led by a variety of very good molecular biologists sequenced ancient mitochondrial DNA from a tiny sample taken from the humerus, the upper arm bone, of the original Neanderthal specimen. Doesn't this sound a little bit like the old amber DNA story that we saw recently, highly popularized in now two movies? we can see this whole Jurassic Park concept actually being seen in science. Actually, it's interesting to note molecular biologists have really laughed at the fiasco that we could pull DNA from insects in amber because it doesn't appear that that works. But this particular study clearly indicates that a DNA specimen, in this case a mitochondrial DNA specimen, taken from the humerus of a Neanderthal could be sequenced. Turns out that these individuals who lived between 130,000 and 27,000 years ago, that's a period of about 115,000 years duration, to 110,000, 115,000 years duration, do not appear directly related as ancestors to modern humans, which seems to be a little bit different than our previous understanding. Some people think that others were derived from Neanderthals. I've heard that term used socially to criticize, oh, he's a Neanderthal. But it turns out that our genetic linkage based on the mitochondrial DNA patterning appears to be very different than that of modern Homo sapiens. As a consequence, it's difficult, not impossible, but very difficult to conceive that our Neanderthal co-inhabitants were really the ancestors of modern humans. Well, the DNA genome, the DNA message found in mitochondria, therefore has a lot to tell us about our genetic history and biochemical individuality. And in fact, it's interesting to note that there are certain antibiotic sensitivities like to chloramphenicol that are traced back through sensitivities to mitochondrial DNA transcription, traced sex-linked back to the mother. Hemolytic anemias due to chloramphenicol appear to be a consequence of this unique genetic susceptibility of the mitochondrial DNA to an antibiotic. Does that seem interesting? Remember, these mitochondria are protists that once infected human cells, and therefore antibiotics of a certain type may actually kill mitochondria. And as such, result in energy deficits, which then can be seen as cell system early stage death. We also see mitochondrial defects found in a variety of neurodegenerative diseases, including Parkinson's disease. Recent evidence in sequencing the mitochondrial DNA indicates that there are certain blueprint codes in mitochondrial DNA that seem to be coded for risk to Parkinson's. This is a consequence of the fact that mitochondrial DNA in part codes for proteins that form the electron transport chain complex 1 through 4, and defects in complex 1 are seen more commonly in the DNA of the mitochondria of Parkinson's patients, which this defect could result in poor electron transport along the electron transport chain, and then a loss of those electrons out the chain, which leads to a, quote, short circuit, end quote, of the mitochondria, and actually a damage then by oxidizing conditions of the local environment. In other words, mitochondrial destruction and cellular pathology. This is a form of oxidant stress, this mitochondrial uncoupling, which is correlated then with a genetic defect in the mitochondrial oxidative transport system. And some individuals may not have enough mutation in their mitochondrial DNA to be born with a frank genetic metabolism disorder of mitochondria, but it may be more a chronic problem related to mitochondrial function and oxidative stress, and this may be encouraged over aging process and the increasing damage to the mitochondria as a consequence of exposure to toxins or heavy metals or oxidant stress factors. So this could be considered an accumulative damage to the cell that expresses decreasing energy production and increasing symptoms of cellular dysfunction, of which two symptoms, fatigue and pain, might result. Interestingly enough, there are now well-documented examples of induced mitochondrial defects in the DNA to mitochondria that are not necessarily genetic, that has come up as a consequence of lifestyle and environmental exposures. We know that, for instance, drug toxicity may induce mitochondrial DNA damage. We know that there is evidence to suggest that long-term exposure to toxins from cigarette smoke may induce oxidation of mitochondrial DNA and alter in the oxidant machinery and the mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation. In fact, there's an interesting paper in Redox Report recently describing a cigarette smoke-induced oxidation and its effect on mitochondrial function, and then the protection by giving higher levels of mitochondrial-specific antioxidants like dihydrolipoic acid and glutathione, or N-acetylcysteine, which is the precursor to glutathione, suggesting that when there's a damage to mitochondrial DNA, that to preserve the residual integrity of the energy-producing machinery and to protect against oxidant damage from these complex proteins that may have been interrupted in electron transport, then you need to increase the level of various insulating factors to put insulation back on the wire of the electron transport chain, which includes antioxidants such as lipoic acid and N-acetylcysteine/glutathione and coenzyme Q10 and vitamin E. I said N-acetylcysteine because that is transported across the mitochondrial membrane where glutathione can be generated in situ, whereas glutathione itself does not appear to be transported across the mitochondrial membrane as the tripeptide. Therefore, N-acetylcysteine may prove preferable. Doses in human studies that have been utilized for these nutrients are in the range of hundreds to as many as a few thousand milligrams, depending upon the degree of oxidative stress and the degree of uncoupling of mitochondrial DNA function. We also have seen the same thing, haven't we, in previous issues of Functional Medicine Update, where I've described the use of N-acetylcysteine supplementation in patients who have HIV. It's seemingly able to help replete glutathione stores and reduce then some of the inflammatory oxidative stress reactions and help protect against mitochondrial DNA damage. We know that AIDS encephalopathy is in part related to mitochondrial, quote, burnout, end quote, and the release of oxidants at the mitochondria is a consequence of upregulation of the immune system or dysregulation of the immune system in glial cell activation, increased nitric oxide output, and uncoupling of mitochondrial function in the neuron. By then administering once again the antioxidants that help to protect against mitochondrial damage, like N-acetylcysteine, it can help reduce then replication of the virus and oxidative stress-induced damage. This was, again, a recent report in Redox Report, Volume 3, page 145 in 1997, looking at the effect of N-acetylcysteine on HIV replication in chronically infected cells. This follows very nicely the work that we described from Stanford University Medical School, again, in human subjects, showing on the order of 3,000 to 5,000 milligrams a day, very high doses of N-acetylcysteine in HIV-infected individuals did appear to have benefit in helping to maintain glutathione stores and reducing oxidant stress factors. Well, if we take this model on beyond mitochondrial DNA, we can take it to the next level, which is a discussion of how this relates to the Pauling and Williams concept of molecular medicine or genetotrophic theory of disease. The example that I think is most eloquent in defining this relationship are in some of the blood disorders, specifically thalassemias and sickle cell disease. You might recall it was 1949 that Dr. Williams started to develop his concept of biochemical individuality, and that was the same year that Dr. Pauling and his then postgraduate doctoral student, Dr. Itano, published their landmark paper on the biochemical nature of the origin of sickle cell anemia. This was published in Science magazine, and I consider it one of the of the classic papers that came out of the Pauling group over some 60 years of science. Dr. Pauling and Itano indicated that there was a point gene mutation found on the one of the chains of hemoglobin, a substitution mutant that related to a conformational change of the hemoglobin molecule, making it able to form more hydrophobic bonds of one hemoglobin with another hemoglobin or globin protein, setting the stage for, quote, crystallization, end quote, of the hemoglobin within the cell, which then results in a shape change of the cell and increased deformation and rheological changes and all the secondary side effects that then occur as a consequence of the disease. And therefore, this was the first example of what was called a molecular disease, where the origin of the molecular disease could be defined at a single substitution of one amino acid for another or a single genetic mutation causing the different conformation of a protein. Well, since then, obviously, molecular medicine has evolved tremendously with the birthing of molecular biology and molecular genetics and with the whole concept of the Human Genome Project and our discovery of the linkages of various disorders to their gene structure, we're now starting to see a virtual explosion of this field. And it's interesting to note that 1949 to 1997, we're looking at almost 50 years, 48 years, and we're starting to see now the emergence of concepts that would modify the transference of this sickle cell trait into the phenotype of the individual by utilizing what Pauling called orthomolecular medicine and what Dr. Roger Williams called the genetotrophic approach to medicine. I am now very interested in the two papers that appeared recently, one in the New England Journal of Medicine on the pathogenesis and treatment of sickle cell disease, This was New England Journal of Medicine, Volume 337, page 762. And the second was entitled Sickle Cell Disease in the Lancet, Volume 350, page 725, in 1997. I found it very interesting that both journals, within a week of one another, had articles on sickle cell anemia. It's almost like a 50-year celebration of the Pauling concept of molecular medicine. In this particular two papers, they talk about what has been learned about modifying the genetic risk factor for this point gene mutation being expressed as the sickle trait. What they show is that there are now ways that we can add certain agents into the environment. These are therapeutic agents like hydroxyurea or arginine butyrate that will, in fact, create the upregulation of the gene expression of fetal hemoglobin, which is still present in the individual's genes that carries the sickle cell trait, but has gone to sleep as they have grown older. And you can awaken this message with a gene response element as hydroxyurea or arginine butyrate. And in so doing, upregulate then the fetal hemoglobin message to be expressed, which then transports its oxygen more effectively, and by so doing can dilute then the sickle cell hemoglobin molecule, which then prevents it from being so readily available for crystallization by hydrophobic bonding with a neighbor that has a similar conformational change. And therefore, here's a very interesting strategy in molecular medicine, which is really orthomolecular medicine, adjusting the molecular milieu of the individual to prevent the expression of a gene that could produce illness and even premature death. And the substances that used are arginine butyrate and or hydroxyurea. It's interesting to note that these conditions of sickle crisis and thalassemic crisis are obviously environmentally modulated. Now, not all individuals who carry these traits have sickle crisis going on or thalassemic crisis, but there are precipitators or triggering factors that relate to the appearance of these genes to be expressed as disease. This is very reminiscent of what Dr. Leo Gallen talks about in the functional medicine precept as the etiology of dysfunction through antecedents, triggers, mediators resulting in signs and symptoms. So what are the triggers that work on the genetic antecedents that give rise then to the appearance of sickle crisis or thalassemic crisis? Well, one contribution are those factors which increase the output of nitric oxide. It's recently been reported, I'm now citing Clinical Chemistry, Volume 43, page 1442 in 1997, that increased nitric oxide output then binds to the thiol residues in hemoglobin and can then trigger a conformational change, whereas the thalassemic hemoglobin or the sickle hemoglobin becomes more dominant in its ability to crystallize in the cell, and it can then increase the risk to a crisis, hypertension, vascular disorders, kidney problems, and so forth. And therefore, what we ask is the conditions that might increase nitric oxide. What are the co-precipitating triggers that would increase nitric oxide? And I think from previous discussions on Functional Medicine Update, you know that nitric oxide is increased in output as a consequence of the upregulation of the immune-inducible form of nitric oxide synthase. And the immune-inducible form of nitric oxide synthase is activated as a consequence of lipopolysaccharides or pro-inflammatory cytokines, which means agents related to gut dysbiosis or immunological activating phenomena in the acute phase reaction, where you get more tumor necrosis factor alpha or interferon 1 being released. Particular pro-inflammatory processes then increase nitric oxide output and set the stage for increased binding of nitric oxide by hemoglobin and in the genetically susceptible individual, making more available in the cells like the red cell, the thalassemic or the sickle hemoglobin to bind with itself and to produce the shape changes that indicate the illness. How do you reduce that triggering factor in a genetically susceptible individual? Well, you reduce things that would create immunological activation, allergies, toxic reactions, endobiosis, situations related to drug exposures, individuals who are in high stress. We know that catecholamines can trigger these reactions, so lower stress, higher quality diets that help to support proper immunological function. All of these things then would be considered strategies in a functional medicine approach towards reducing the expression of those agents which would induce then the sickle cell response. The sickle cell or thalassemic response also activates oxidative stress machinery through the mitochondrial uncoupling that we described earlier. So antioxidants have also been shown to be helpful in reducing sickle cell risk and thalassemic risk, particularly vitamin E, given at reasonably high doses, 400 to 1,000 IUs per day. Work of Dr. Lemo Bowie, B-O-W-I-E, has shown that vitamin E can help to reduce the risk of sickle crisis. And we also know that agents that would prevent the binding of nitric oxide with hemoglobin or sulfhydryl residues on hemoglobin can reduce some of these risk factors as well. An interesting paper, again, in Redox Report, Volume 3, page 159 in 1997, talked about glutathione and it's serving as a sink to soak up the nitric oxide so that it's not available for binding to the hemoglobin sulfhydryl group. So you might consider glutathione as being a quenching factor, and it also helps a release of iron, which can further initiate the oxidative stress reactions and trigger damage to the red cell. The N-acetylcysteine glutathione connection comes back once again in the terms of manipulating the molecular environment and preventing the expression of the phenotype of the thalassemic or sickle cell individual. So I think it's interesting to note that over 50 years of evolution since the Pauling and Williams original constructs, we're now starting to see filter into traditional thought gene manipulators that are based on nutrient loading or orthomolecular medicine concepts. And again, the doses that we're talking about here are far greater than one would normally think of from dietary intake, greater than a cell would normally synthesize on its own from de novo biosynthesis of glutathione, but they are doses that are that which help to modulate the internal milieu of an individual at specific risk, then mediated by a number of triggering factors which come from lifestyle, diet, and environment, as we described with the sickle cell crisis. Well, another agent that is known to contribute to these kinds of toxic responses are the families of pharmacologically active substances that help to reduce symptoms, in other words, medications. One that is very commonly used, OTC, over-the-counter, is paracetamol or acetaminophen. And we know that there is a high level of toxicity associated with its abuse. What is the source of the hepatotoxicity associated with paracetamol or acetaminophen, and how do we prevent it in individuals who are susceptible? Well, the estimated number of overdoses to acetaminophen range in the United States well in excess of 200,000 per year, so this is not an insignificant medical problem. We recognize that the treatment of acetaminophen overdose in the emergency room of hospitals is to put an NG tube down and to force down mucomist, which is N-acetylcysteine. N-acetylcysteine is a substance which, as we've described earlier, activates the production of glutathione and helps to restore tissue glutathione and mitochondrial glutathione levels. We know that in the absence of administration of some kind of a therapeutic agent in the face of acetaminophen toxicity, the liver can be seriously damaged. Actually, death can ensue in the most extreme cases as a consequence of hepatic failure. Well, what is the cause of that? The cause is that acetaminophen is metabolized in the body by a series of phase 1 cytochrome P450s and phase 2 conjugases, principally glucuronidation and sulfation. When there is a very high level of activation of the metabolism of acetaminophen, which can occur by either overdose or by poor liver function of phase 2 glucuronidation, then the acetaminophen is pushed through a secondary metabolic detoxification pathway, which is glutathione conjugation, to form the glutathione conjugate, or called mercapturate, acetaminophen mercapturate. This pathway is normally not highly activated, except in cases where very high intakes of acetaminophen occur or there is a functional deficiency of phase 2 glucuronidation. In that case, an intermediary compound called NAPQI, which is basically a byproduct, a quinone byproduct from the partial metabolism of acetaminophen, is produced, and this is extraordinarily hepatotoxic. And if it cannot be quenched by adequate glutathione stores, then it can induce serious damage to the liver. What happens in the case of high production in the liver of NAPQI is that the glutathione stores can be rapidly compromised if the individual has had poor quality diet or already has depleted glutathione reserves as a consequence of oxidative stress. In this case, then, there's not available glutathione for the conjugation, and now NAPQI exerts its deleterious effect. To increase, then, the available glutathione stores or trapping stores for the formation of the NAPQI byproducts, which are detoxified byproducts, then we need higher levels of intake therapeutic of the precursors to glutathione, and so comes to play the N-acetylcysteine story. Individuals, therefore, who have poor phase 2 glucuronidation and are exposed to substances that have a secondary pathway going through toxic intermediates that can be detoxified by glutathione conjugation, then require higher levels of these glutathione-stimulating nutrients like N-acetylcysteine for proper support of detoxification. This is particularly the case when there's an upregulation of phase 1 oxidative machinery, which occurs, say, with starvation or with alcohol intake. And we've described the paper that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association 2 years ago that indicated that either a fasting or alcohol taken along with acetaminophen greatly magnifies the hepatotoxicity, because starvation will cause a depletion of glutathione reserves and upregulates the phase 1 oxidative cytochrome P450s. And so what you end up having happen is increased production of NAPQI and potential damage to the liver. So this is another example of managing toxicity with the use of a nutritional cofactor that pushes equilibrium towards completion. We're going to talk also about hepatic encephalopathy, because that's another very interesting example of a condition that we often associate only with hospitalized patients, but really has much more to say about chronic encephalopathic conditions that lead to change in brain chemistry, hallucinations, and other kinds of altered brain biochemical functions that may exhibit chronic symptoms of altered cognitive function, and how that relates to toxic burden as well. The hepatic encephalopathy story is very interesting from this functional medicine perspective, because we used to think that the psychosis as a consequence of hepatic encephalopathy was principally a result of hyperammonemia, the buildup of ammonia. What is the source of ammonia? Where does it come from? We all recognize from our physiological training that the source of ammonia comes from deamination of amino acids by gut bacteria, particularly deaminating bacteria, which are of the type 3 or class 3 putrefying bacteria, the so-called parasitic bacterial families like Clostridial bacteria and Salmonella. These deaminating bacteria then increase the load of ammonia traveling from the gut to the liver, and in the case of compromised liver deamination or ammonia detoxification pathways, i.e. reductions in urea cycle efficiency, there is then the opportunity for ammonia to spill over from the liver into plasma and then be transported to the brain, producing a tie-up of keto acids in the brain and the brain biochemical disturbances associated with hepatic encephalopathy. This really should be called gastrointestinal hepatic encephalopathy, because clearly it's an indication of the gut connected to the liver connected to the brain. More recently, however, it's been found that there are other substances beyond that of ammonia which may be responsible for the psychosis and brain disturbances found in hepatic encephalopathy. And in fact, studies have indicated that there are cases of normal plasma ammonia levels, very low and undetectable, but very significant encephalopathic changes that could be traced back to the plasma presence of other amino acid breakdown products or toxic amino substances that have names like putrescine, cadaverine. These names obviously have their own implications without me going into them, but they are toxic byproducts, biogenic amines, which can serve as their own putative precursors to neurotransmitters or alter then brain biochemical function. Therefore, the approach that's been suggested for the treatment of hepatic encephalopathy has generally been directed towards the gut to lower then the load of these toxic amino substances. This includes things like the use of lactulose to create a diarrhea situation and then eliminate toxic amine substances from the gut. Also, a lower protein diet has been employed in individuals with hepatic encephalopathy to lower the substrate loading. And more recently, and I think of more interest, is the use of gut restoration programs things to alter the populations of bacteria to increase the friendly bacteria that are not deaminating. These are the lactobacillus families. Lactobacillus bacteria actually can competitively inhibit the deaminating bacteria that are associated with the production of these toxic amine compounds, including ammonia. A few controlled studies have been reported, including lactobacillus acidophilus supplements for up to 4 weeks, which produced marked clinical improvement in 71% of patients with hepatic encephalopathy that were refractory to neomycin alone. In fact, in a crossover study in 3 patients, this is a second study, it suggested that the treatment with L-acidophilus alone may have been less effective than when given along with an antibiotic that caused the first death of the toxic bacteria and the recolonization of the friendly bacteria. So it may be a combination therapy that is more following our 4R program: remove, replace, reinoculate, and repair. You recall that's the acronym we've used for gastrointestinal restoration therapy. Remove means to get rid of the toxic producing byproducts, which could be parasites or toxic bacteria, and this is the appropriate therapy utilized for removal. This also includes Helicobacter pylori, I might add. There's a very strong suggestion, although it hasn't been proven, that a covariable infection with H. pylori increases the risk then to hyperammonemia and hepatic encephalopathy. This is because H. pylori is known to have a urease enzyme, a system that is secreted, which then increases the breakdown of urea into ammonia and could increase the load of nitrogenous substances. So a covariable infection with toxic colonic bacteria and H. pylori in the duodenum could greatly increase the risk then to hepatic encephalopathy, particularly obviously in individuals with compromised urea cycle hepatic function, which is often seen in older age individuals. So if you get hypochlorhydria associated with aging, bacterial overgrowth, and increased toxic bacterial frequency of population in the gut, and increased deamination then of protein to ammonia and other toxic amines, and a compromised urea cycle hepatic detoxification system, now you have all the markers for increased risk of brain biochemical disturbances and what will later be called hepatic encephalopathy. So acidophilus replacement therapy after removal of toxic bacteria as part of the 4R gut restoration program seems to have clinically been demonstrated of importance. Secondly is the suggestion that branched-chained amino acids and a diet that's low in protein that's rich in aromatic amino acids seems to have a positive impact on reducing the incidence or risk of hepatic encephalopathy. Isoleucine and leucine, which are the branched-chained amino acids, seem to be more beneficial in reduction of risk, whereas the aromatic amino acids, phenylalanine, tyrosine, and tryptophan, appear to increase the risk of hepatic encephalopathy. Therefore, animal proteins that are rich in the aromatic amino acids may increase risk, and branched-chained amino acids may decrease the risk. Clinical studies trying to look at this in controlled protocols have not been able to demonstrate a very substantial decrease in hepatic encephalopathy with the branched-chain amino acid-rich diets. But if they were further enriched with urea cycle amino acid L-ornithine, then there was a considerable reduction in the evidence of hepatic encephalopathy. So L-ornithine may be very effective along with branched-chain amino acids for additional benefit in patients who have gut dysbiosis, bacterial deamination, and increased nitrogenous toxin accumulation in plasma. The study that I think is most interesting in that area is looking at vegetable versus animal protein diets in cirrhotic patients with chronic encephalopathy. And in this case where they used a vegetable protein-rich diet that was lower in some of the urea cycle amino acids, they got less beneficial effect than using a high ornithine diet. If they then supplemented with additional ornithine and branched-chain amino acids, they got even more significant clinical improvement. This is the Journal of Internal Medicine, Volume 233, page 385 in 1993, that had that discussion. So we're really talking about an approach towards lowering the risk then of toxic substance production in the gut that the liver then can no longer properly detoxify, and that then can result in brain biochemical disturbances. This might also have some relationships to chronic fatigue-related symptoms as well. Recently, a paper was published by Dr. Hugh Dunstan and his colleagues from Newcastle University Medical School and the University of Sydney Westmead Hospital in Australia. This is entitled, Preliminary Assessment, of urinary metabolites and psychological responses in patients with chronic fatigue syndrome. And what these investigators identified, this is published in the Journal of Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, Volume 3, page 17 in 1997, they identified the fact that there were unique urinary metabolites that were excreted in the urine of chronic fatigue syndrome patients that were not found in control patients of same sex and age. They suggest that these metabolites are indicative of bacterial secondary metabolites and therefore may indicate some type of endotoxicity connection with fatigue-like syndromes. Again, we would see chronic fatigue syndrome as being maybe multifactorial and having multiple contributions to etiology, but certainly one of these may emerge to be a toxic accumulation as a consequence of gut endodysbiosis and toxicity. We come back then to look at how this relates to the 4R program, remove, replace, reinoculate, and repair. And we're reminded once again that lactobacillus acidophilus supplementation, along with inulin, fructose oligosaccharides, and other gut fuel that improves then butyrate formation in the gut as short-chain fatty acid and improves then the proliferation of the friendly class 1 bacteria at the expense of elimination of class 3 toxic bacteria, can be facilitated while the individual's on a low iron diet. Why low iron? This is a very interesting new connection. It turns out that lactobacillus is one of the few bacteria, one of the few organisms actually, that does not require iron for its growth. It has total iron abstinence. And therefore, if you want to stimulate the growth of lactobacillus selectively by putting a person on a low iron diet, the lactobacillus will do fine. It will not starve. But other bacteria, the toxic bacteria like Salmonella or Clostridia that require iron for their growth, will be competitively starved. This is a very interesting report recently from Perspectives in Biology and Medicine, Volume 40, page 578 in 1997, discussing this lactobacillus anomaly. They go on to point out in this article that by administering high iron diets, these would be meat-based diets, that you'll really stimulate more formation of the toxic bacteria that are growing off iron as one of the critical nutrients, and you then cause a reduction in the lactobacillus. So if you're doing the 4R program, it's suggested that the patient should be on a low iron intake, not iron deficient, not producing hematological aberrations, but low iron intake so as to give a competitive advantage to lactobacillus acidophilus at the expense of the iron-requiring bacteria. We also know that in so doing, if you get increased short-chain fatty acid production in the colon and you reduce then the deaminating bacteria and you lower beta-glucuronidase levels in the stool, which is indicative of lowered toxic bacterial proliferation, then you are also lowering the risk to colonic cancer. This is a very interesting paper recently published in Carcinogenesis, Volume 18, page 1535 in 1997, in which the investigators instilled human flora into the colon of animals and then fed them high or low risk factor diets for colon cancer and showed that human class 3 bacteria, the toxic bacteria, the deconjugating bacteria, the deaminating bacteria, the bacteria that produce beta-glucuronidase that uncouples then the glucuronic acids from detoxified substances, those were enhanced in a high-fat, low-fiber, high-refined carbohydrate diet versus a low-risk factor diet, which was one that had increased levels of soluble and insoluble fiber, more resistant starch, properly balanced with protein, in a diet that had more of the oligosaccharide component. A diet that, again, supports the 4R gastrointestinal restoration program for gut mucosal regeneration is a diet that also has apparently a lowered risk factor to producing carcinogenic metabolites in situ. We also know that endobiosis and the toxic bacterial insult can activate the gut-associated lymphoid tissue to produce more immune-activating cytokines and increase then nitric oxide output, as we've discussed previously. Recently, it's been suggested that L-arginine supplementation can help to influence then the toxic effects due to gut dysbiosis. L-arginine is a modulator of nitric oxide, can produce more immune competency and can produce a vasodilation, increased perfusion, and immune activation. So in this particular suggestion that one might have benefit from L-arginine supplementation, so we've talked about ornithine supplementation for hyperammonemia and hepatic encephalopathy, and now we're talking about L-arginine supplementation. This is a very exciting new chapter that we're seeing emerge as it relates to how to treat systemic inflammatory conditions and immune activation utilizing gut-focused therapies that would restore proper biological flora and GALT, gut-associated lymphoid tissue activity. As we move to side two, we're going to take this discussion and translate it over into insulin resistance and the relationship it has to a whole variety of chronic age-related diseases. We're ready to move into our Clinician of the Month section, but before we do, I'd like to introduce the fact that this will continue to explore the relationship between insulin sensitivity, glucose control, and a whole range of age-related disorders. This theme has been passed through several previous issues of Functional Medicine Update and will continue to, I think, emerge in the importance that this particular topic has in the whole nature of disease prevention. We're very fortunate this month, as our Clinician of the Month, to have, I believe for the first time, and I went back and checked our records, and it seems that I'm right in this memory, the first time a vascular surgeon, a thoracic surgeon, an individual who has many years of experience in the surgical theater, and who brings an interest and a demonstrated knowledge of nutrition and its relationship to his patients to the fore. And I think that's a very interesting blend. It's not a common combination. And so we feel very fortunate to have Dr. Morrison Bethea with us today, who is very actively involved in present state of medicine as a graduate of Davidson College and Tulane University School of Medicine. He's completed his postgraduate training in thoracic and cardiac surgery at the Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center in New York, and he practices thoracic, cardiac, and vascular surgery in New Orleans, and I think you will all tell his origin from New Orleans. He's got that wonderful New Orleans accent, which I think most of us feel like it's very listenable. So I think you'll find him, both in terms of his understanding of his field and in his style of delivery, to be a very powerful contributor to Functional Medicine Update. He's a medical consultant to the Freeport-McMoRan Worldwide Operations and sits on the board of the Taylor Energy and Advisory Board of Mercy Hospital in New Orleans. And it's with great pleasure, then, that we welcome you, Dr. Bethea, to Functional Medicine Update. And let me start with the first question. I think a question that probably most of our listeners are sitting there wondering, how would a vascular thoracic surgeon ever come to be interested in something related to nutrition? Seems like it's not a traditional part of a surgeon's interest.
Well, it's not a traditional part of a surgeon's interest, but I think it's a very important part that maybe we have overlooked. But first, I'd like to thank you for having me on Functional Medicine Update. I've enjoyed your tapes and have gleaned a lot of useful information from them. So to have an opportunity to participate with you is an added pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. You know, you're one of the co-authors of a book that Barbara Schultz, who's in our clinical research center, had read and was very impressed with and said, Jeff, you have to read this book because it is so understandable and it's so motivating for patients to get some insight into their nutrition state, and it's called Sugar Busters, Cut Sugar to Trim Fat, and it's co-authored with three other authors. But I found this to be one of the most well-written, insightful books. You've taken a lot of what might be considered very polysyllabic, sophisticated information and distilled it down into an effective learning system for patients. Tell me how this book came about and how it relates to what you do as a medical professional.
It came about as a result of one of our co-authors, Leighton Stewart, while visiting in Paris, came across a book written by Michel Montagnac, a Frenchman. The name of the book was Dine Out and Lose Weight. And Michel had noticed that throughout the world, literally, especially in developed countries, obesity is increasing at an alarming rate. And he noticed or made the observation that the French people, by and large, have less obesity. And indeed, if one looks at World Health Organizational studies, they see that the French, as a population, have lower cholesterols and on age-adjusted bases, less strokes and heart attacks than other developed countries. So Montagnac wrote a book outlining specifically how the French have eaten for decades. And as you know, they eat wonderful foods. They are gourmets, but they eat lean and trim meats, high fiber vegetables, and whole grain cereals and breads. The higher fiber content having a tremendous effect on our metabolic processes. Leighton brought this back and asked me what I thought about it, and I told him that I thought it was very logical and practical, but yet people were going to be compliant, they needed to understand why it worked. So as we began to look into the concept, which later the book Sugar Busters mirrors, we saw that the bottom line was basically controlling insulin secretion, modulating it downward while at the same time increasing glucagon secretion. And just this year on your program, you've had several nice discussions about the importance of insulin, the importance of glucagon, and the importance of maintaining blood sugars in an acceptable range. And that's what Sugar Busters is doing. And obviously all of these factors have a tremendous influence on the cardiovascular system. The most common question asked me in my practice today is, Doctor, how can I avoid getting arteriosclerosis, atherosclerosis, or hardening of the arteries? And my answer is, and being quite candid, patients don't want to avoid it. They want to live the best they can with it, and by using healthy lifestyle habits can decrease the progression of it. Arteriosclerosis is an aging process. As we get older, we will all be victims of these changes. But by using healthy lifestyle habits in the forms of nutritional supports and vitamins and some of the other things, antioxidants that are coming into play, we can decrease the progression of this process. We can slow our aging. So that's where my interest developed, because I saw an area that we have really not taken advantage of that can have significant ramifications to our benefit in the cardiovascular arena.
That is a very insightful observation, and I was very intrigued and interested when I looked at the at your co-authors in the book to see that you've got Dr. Samuel Anders Andrews, who is a graduate of the Louisiana State University School of Medicine and works in the endocrinology area, and Dr. Luis Ballart, who's a graduate also of Louisiana State Medical University and works at the Ochsner Clinic in gastroenterology. So it appears as if you've got an interesting team along with Leighton Stewart in the way that you viewed this. Do you four have the chance to sit down and kind of form a collegium of discussion of how these concepts translate across your disciplines?
We certainly have, and we continue to do so. As more and more information substantiating our basic concept of controlling insulin secretion is coming to the forefront. Sam Andrews, endocrinologist, has a large practice of diabetic patients, and on our Sugar Busters concept, he has been able to reduce or, if not eliminate, insulin injections for many of his patients. Lewis is also head of the liver transplant program at LSU Medical Center and has a superb knowledge of hepatic metabolism. And as you know, the liver is our metabolic computer, and it orchestrates what happens to everything we eat and consume in a day's period of time. And we felt by taking the cardiovascular area, which is the area that is so often talked about when we think of health and health problems, especially trying to decrease the risk of strokes and heart attacks and other problems related to the vascular system. And by combining that with the expertise of an endocrinologist and a hepatologist, that we would have all of the expertise we really needed to be able to competently put together what we have done in Sugar Busters. And Leighton, being the CEO, has been our manager. He's the one who keeps everyone on focus and moving towards our objective.
Well, I think you certainly have achieved those objectives, and now I'm going to get into some of the more probably controversial questions. As you know, having heard a little bit of Functional Medicine Update in the past, we've been trying to chronicle this debate between the high complex carbohydrate, high fiber individuals and the high protein, lower carbohydrate individuals. That would be to characterize it's the Dean Ornish versus the Barry Sears types of debates. Where does your group fall on this spectrum of internal debate about whether we should be high protein and lower carbohydrate, or higher complex carbohydrate, modest protein, low fat? Do you have a sympathy as it relates to this debate?
We certainly do. And I would say we fall where we think is very practical and logical. We want our persons following our concept to have lean and trimmed meats. We want them to be careful and cautious about fat intake, but not so concerned about fat that they throw away sources of lean and trimmed meats to try to reach either a zero or a very low fat intake. We want them to have carbohydrates, but we want them to have the high fiber carbohydrates, and we want them to have the high fiber grain products that have not been processed. And then, obviously, there will be some fat intake, which we all need, as it comes in combination with the lean and trim meats. Now, we feel that a high protein and moderately high fat and low carbohydrate diet is not healthy. Our biochemistry and physiology works off using carbohydrates as an energy source. If one does not take in enough carbohydrates, then they go into a ketotic state of metabolism, which is not healthy, somewhat similar to the diabetic that's in ketoacidosis. Sure, someone can lose weight eating in this fashion, but it is not sustainable, and it is not a healthy way to lose weight. I think looking at the other side of the spectrum, where individuals have eliminated meat and fat and eaten only carbohydrates, they have been disappointed in their ability to control their weight. Unfortunately, many people see fat, they think fat, they eliminate fat, and they don't understand why they're not losing weight. And it's simply because we do not store sugar in any appreciable amount. Most of the sugar that we take in, which is the breakdown product of carbohydrate, ultimately ends up as fat. Since 1970, the American public has reduced fat intake by 16%. However, in 1970, 1 in 5 Americans were overweight. In 1990, 1 in 3 Americans were overweight. And by the year 2000, almost half of Americans will be overweight. And today, over half of our children are already overweight. And it is because the consumption of sugar products, predominantly processed grain and refined sugar products, has greatly increased. When one walks into a grocery store and sees no cholesterol and low fat, it should continue to say high sugar. Now, we are not recommending that someone eat a low sugar or low carbohydrate diet. We're asking people to be cognizant of the refined and processed sugar and grain products that they're eating. It's fine to have stone ground whole grain bread, but don't eat stone ground whole grain bread that has added brown sugar, honey, molasses, or corn syrup just for sweetening benefits. If one is going to have cereal, have shredded wheat or whole grain oats or whole grain other types of cereals. Don't have cereals that are laced with sugar and frosting and honey and all of the added sugar that we don't need. So our concept will probably mean that one eats less sugar than they are accustomed to eating, but it is not a low-carbohydrate diet, because we want one to have plenty of carbohydrates, but they need to be those carbohydrates that have the higher fiber content. The fiber acts as an impurity. It slows digestion, slows absorption, slows the elevation of blood sugar, and by doing that, slows the secretion of insulin. And insulin, we all know, is necessary for us to live. We cannot live without insulin, but we live much better without too much insulin. And many of your audience will know that insulin is necessary to get glucose or sugar into a cell. But insulin has several other significant functions that many people are not aware of. Insulin causes all unused sugar to be stored as fat. Insulin prevents us from burning fat as an energy source. And insulin also stimulates our livers to produce cholesterol. And they're those last three functions that we have to be very careful and not allow too high insulin levels to cause our systems to develop in an unhealthy fashion.
Well, that was a whole medical school semester of intermediary metabolism in 5 minutes. I compliment you. I wish I could do so well. That was beautiful.
Well, thank you.
One of the things that I think probably some of our listeners are now saying is, boy, oh boy, this is pretty amazing to have Dr. Bethea talk this way, because the Bogalusa Heart Study in New Orleans, I mean, we start thinking of Louisiana as the center for cardiovascular disease and rich diets and premature atherosclerosis. How has this message gone down in your patients? How has it been accepted?
The Bogalusa Study?
Well, I was thinking more or less of the approach that you're advocating with your patients.
Well, it is going down very well, and we are exceedingly pleased with the acceptance and the success that people are having. You know, the Bogalusa study is an ongoing study. It's encompasses about 20 years. And Dr. Gerald Barrington followed patients in Bogalusa from birth until adulthood. And he found, and this is published in Circulation in January of 1996, he found that the first measurable change in our blood chemistries in a young adult before the onset of diabetes, symptomatic cardiovascular disease, hypertension, and obesity was a rising insulin level. That was the first measurable abnormality he could determine. And in fact, there have been other studies, more recently in the New England Journal of Medicine, that have pointed out that high insulin levels are an independent risk factor for cardiovascular disease, exactly like smoking and heredity and high cholesterol and some of the others. So as you see, it's quite natural that a cardiovascular surgeon would become interested in these concepts, especially when eating in this fashion has several other benefits. Not only does it take the peaks and the valleys out of the day, making one's performance better, but there are nice studies that have shown that high-fiber diets decrease colon cancer and may indeed reduce breast cancer.
Well, that leads me then to the questions concerning micronutrients. We had really two previous presenters on Functional Medicine Update that have spoken from their positions. One is Dr. Edward Segal at Boston University Medical Center, who made the statement that it's both the amount and type of fat that's important for vascular risk and vascular disease risk. And he talked about the omega-3 fatty acids and how as we go to these refined diets, we get more and more of the partially hydrogenated vegetable oils and less of the omega-3. And second was Dr. Kilmer McCulley, who talked about folic acid, vitamin B6 and vitamin B12 and the homocysteine connection to heart disease and the importance of getting adequate B vitamins in this unrefined complex carbohydrate-rich diet. Do you have any thoughts about how your dietary approach incorporates the types of fats and the vitamin density?
Well, yes, we think that I think that those all of those points are very important. We feel that one, as I said, should be careful about the fat intake. We recommend that one for oils and cooking that they use fats that are high in polyunsaturated and primarily monounsaturated fats, such as the olive oil. As far as some of the other vitamins, we feel that that's important, and we feel that natural, unprocessed carbohydrates, your leafy green vegetables and others are an excellent source of these. And it's actually the processing and the stripping and the refinement that tends to remove a lot of these from food sources. And when one goes in a grocery store and sees that something is enriched, it is enriched because it has been processed to the point that many of the natural nutrients have been removed. So if one tends to eat those foods that are not processed and not refined, they retain the nutrients that naturally occur in these foods.
We're into a very interesting period in medical history that you know probably even better than I what it means, Dr. Bethea, and that's this era of managed care and evidence-based medicine and outcome analysis and putting financial markers on looking at efficacy rather than sometimes looking at patient care questions. Often some of the doctors that are involved with this integrated form of healthcare where they're looking at multiple solutions to problems from multiple perspectives are confronted with the dilemma that, gee whiz, it takes time to talk to their patients about these things, and there's no convenient ICD-9 or CPT coding that they can use for these discussions, and therefore we're getting into an efficiency-based medicine that's really write a prescription and send the patient out of the office without giving them the benefit of full information. How do you deal with these concepts in the scope of your practice, knowing that you're working in this managed care milieu as well?
Well, I think these concepts are very important. I think that managed care is rightly so working towards preventative medicine, is working towards having us be aware of our health and trying to prevent a problem. It's certainly cheaper to prevent a health problem than to treat it once it occurs. In fact, in the August 1996 issue of Scientific American, it was pointed out that this country, the United States, is spending $45.8 billion a year on health care costs directly attributable to persons being overweight. And there's another $23 billion a year in wages, compensation, and other forms of remuneration being lost by these individuals because they're either in hospitals or going to see a doctor. So we have a greater than a $60 billion a year health care problem directly attributable to fat. And in my practice, those patients that are normal weight, not obese, have good tissue integrity and so forth, go through cardiac and major vascular procedures with much, much lower complications than the persons that are even moderately overweight. Infection, bleeding, pneumonia, just to name a few problems, there's a marked difference between these two types of patients. So one can, in many instances, prevent a lot of health problems by paying attention to how they take care of themselves. And if they do have certain problems, they can go through the treatment and be cured with much less risk of either death or complication if they have taken better care of themselves. So I think this whole avenue of functional medicine connects very nicely with what we're trying to do in healthcare today from a preventative standpoint.
Well, I thank you. I believe you have given us kind of a blueprint of what might be called integrative medicine and systems thinking. And I know you've opened the minds of all of our listeners. And those that want to get a copy of your book, is there a place that they can call in order to place an order? I think this is a great patient education tool.
My book is distributed by Ingram to all major bookstores throughout the United States. So if they would go into a major bookstore in their community, they would be able to purchase it or have the bookstore order it for them. If not, they could call in the New Orleans area, area code 504-897-6770, or either fax a request for a book to that order, to that number, and we would be most happy to have a book sent to them. We have been very pleased with the response that persons have given us. We have seen lower cholesterols, lower triglycerides, and we have seen persons lose weight. And again, the purpose is not to have one lose weight to the extent that they quote a New York model. We don't feel that that's necessarily a healthy weight. We feel that one's healthy weight is their genetically predetermined weight. So some persons are going to be heavier than others, but usually that is less weight than most people have today. And as our title suggests, Sugar Busters, our own Department of Agriculture, United States Department of Agriculture, through 1994 showed that the average American eats 149.2 pounds of added refined sugar a year. That's over a third of a pound a day. And if one does not believe it, just take a little time and look at the labels of the different food sources and substances that they are buying in the supermarkets and look at the added sugar, and they will be amazed. And they will also be amazed at how well they can control their weight and how much better they feel when they take steps to reduce the consumption of this added sugar.
Well, I want to thank you on behalf of all of our listeners for your very insightful and eloquent comments. And I think that people can use this book in their practice for their patient education applications. And that's part of this whole story is patient education. You get a proactive patient and they can be much more in a self-regulation mode and much less demanding of the expenditures of the healthcare system. So I thank you very much for giving you this motivation today.
Well, it has been my pleasure, and I look forward to your continued update on many areas which I personally have found most interesting as well as being beneficial to my patients and to me.
Thank you so much, and we'll check back in another time. Best to you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. I want to once again thank Dr. Bethea for his very eloquent and insightful discussion of the important role that insulin sensitivity plays clinically in reducing the risk of a whole variety of conditions. And I think the combination of vascular, endocrine, and gastrointestinal hepatic perspectives that is witnessed by the authors of the book Sugar Busters is a illustration of what is happening in synthesis of this new paradigm of functional medicine, where the disciplinary myopia that we've seen emerge among disciplines, especially over the past 20 years, is now starting to come back and converge into a synthesis that leads us to recognizing the web-like nature of human physiology and treating the whole individual. In that context, I'd like to take up some of the charge of Dr. Bethea and look at the relationship of insulin sensitivity to a variety of other clinical manifestations. First of all, endocrine balance. What about the elevated insulin effects upon the pregnenolone metabolism through the 17,20 lyase enzyme inhibition and shunting then more of the steroid hormone precursor pregnenolone into cortisol and the relationship then that has to dehydroepiandrosterone metabolism? In insulin insensitivity, we often see elevated levels of cortisol and reduced levels of DHEA. This is described in a recent article very nicely in Medical Hypothesis, Volume 49, page 85 in 1997, in which the authors from the Department of Physiology at Northwestern University Medical School have talked about DHEA as a hormone that's related to taking its message from how pregnenolone gets shunted into cortisol. As plasma concentrations of total DHEA and total cortisol, which is expressed as the cortisol to DHEA ratio, go up, this is associated then with insulin resistance or insulin insensitivity and dysglycemia. This is a very common phenomena of endocrinological change seen with biological aging, and therefore elevated levels of the cortisol to DHEA ratio could be considered an age-related risk factor that is signaled from endocrine shifting. These individuals, if they're women, often are shifted towards androgen versus estrogen balance, so they tend to not only be hypercortisol, but they also tend to be hypertestosterone and lower estrogen. They tend to correlate with the polycystic ovary conditions and the abdominal obesity, increased LDL cholesterol, as well as a risk to type 2 diabetes. And therefore, as the insulin resistance increases, endocrine shifts can occur that are then monitored as altered cortisol to DHEA ratios. Cortisol to DHEA ratio goes up. In the past, people have said, well, then just give DHEA supplements to raise then the DHEA level and to balance the cortisol to DHEA ratio. But actually, this is not in and itself the most viable strategy, because by filling more of the pipeline with DHEA and not balancing the cortisol increase, one might then get a general endocrinological overload. In fact, the primary approach should be first to balance insulin levels, reestablishing insulin sensitivity through the approach that Dr. Bethea was mentioning, then come back and monitor cortisol to DHEA ratios after those dietary changes and lifestyle modifications have been made, and see if there is a necessity for hormonal intervention, rather than starting as a primary therapy and jumping to the rather simplistic conclusion that if DHEA is low, administer it. One should be looking at ratios and where the metabolic block occurs, which is potentially at the pregnenolone step. Secondly, we have recognized that one of the important dietary variables that can help to sensitize insulin to tissues and to improve insulin sensitivity and glucoregulation is the nutritional essential trace element, chromium. In a recent paper, it was described that trivalent chromium may be a very important nutrient to be given in supplementary levels in a type 2 diabetic prevention program in individuals who have varying degrees of insulin resistance. We now recognize that the Diabetes Prevention Program, which is this $150 million National Institutes of Health-sponsored study designed to determine whether non-insulin-dependent diabetes can be prevented, did not, in fact, include chromium supplementation as one of the arms of the trial, but rather it's looking at lifestyle intervention with diet and exercise, metformin as an investigational drug in comparison to standard diet and a control group. The suggestion, however, from the literature that's been published that chromium may play an additionally important role in helping to stabilize insulin sensitivity and improve in glucoregulation was not incorporated in the work, and those studies indicate somewhere in the range of 200 to 400 micrograms, maybe as much in some cases as 600 micrograms of trivalent chromium as being beneficial in individuals who have impaired insulin sensitivity. Not all individuals will respond to chromium because there are differing reasons for insulin resistance, but those individuals that have insulin resistance related to the chromium-mediated glucose tolerance factor effects will respond very nicely, and therefore a clinical trial can be used administering 200 micrograms three times daily of trivalent chromium as a glucose tolerance factor chromium to see if a person's glucose response and insulin response after eating will in fact improve. If it does show marked improvement, then it can be assumed that person is a chromium-responsive individual and it represents a primary part of their therapy. A recent controlled trial that looked at chromium and exercise and its effect on glucose tolerance was published in the Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise Journal. This is, I think, a very interesting paper, volume 29, page 992 in 1997, in which chromium supplementation was provided versus a placebo to young, obese women who were put on a modest exercise program. This was a chromium picolinate in this particular case, given at the level of 400 micrograms a day. So this was 200 micrograms twice daily was the supplementation program. They concluded that the higher levels of chromium supplementation provided in this case as chromium picolinate seemed to suggest that when combined with exercise may be more beneficial in improving insulin sensitivity than just exercise alone, and therefore might be even more beneficial in reducing coronary artery disease and non-insulin diabetes-related risk factors. Again, this is a what I would call a observational control study. It wouldn't be a study that we would probably, quote, go to the bank with, end quote, but it certainly suggests the benefit of chromium supplementation in modestly obese women who are just starting on to an exercise program. We also recognize that insulin resistance increases oxidative stress in individuals, and therefore their need for antioxidant nutrients may be modified. There are studies indicating that vitamin E supplementation in humans given at the dose of 200 to 400 international units per day given to individuals with dysglycemia can help to reduce oxidative stress reactions in these individuals. Vitamin E is also known, along with other antioxidants, to help support immune system function, which in insulin-resistant individuals can be impaired as well. A recent paper in the Journal of the American College of Nutrition, volume 16, page 357 in 1997, demonstrated the value in 57 subjects older age individuals, actually, who consumed a multivitamin mineral supplement rich in antioxidants, including 20 milligrams of zinc, 100 micrograms of selenium, 120 milligrams of vitamin C, 6 milligrams of beta-carotene, 15 milligrams of vitamin E, that this particular supplement, even though it was fairly low potency, was found to improve immunological function by in vitro measurements and lowered oxidative response. So even at modest supplementation, improved immunological function can be seen in older age individuals who often have insulin resistance. We also know the type of fat in the diet plays an important role in helping to stabilize insulin to cell membranes. That has to do with, again, increasing the omega-3 dietary fatty acid intake at the expense of lower saturated fats, particularly the long-chain saturated fats like stearic acid and palmitic acid. A recent paper in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 66, page 591 in 1997, indicated that alpha-linolenic acid supplementation, which is abbreviated ALA, that's the principal fatty acid of the omega-3 family found in flaxseed oil and some of the beans as well, that alpha-linolenic acid seemed to be metabolically convertible into the eicosanoids that help to stabilize platelet dynamics and vascular dynamics almost as well as omega-3 oils coming from fish oil, which are the chain elongated desaturated oils like eicosapentaenoic acid. So most individuals, unless they have a specific metabolic block in the chain elongation desaturation pathways, will respond to a supplementation of omega-3 oils as alpha-linolenic acid, which comes from flax, rather than having to rely upon omega-3 fish oils. I do, however, want to place a caveat clinically in this discussion in that people who are truly diabetic and have a very significant impairment then in the delta-6 and delta-5 desaturase enzymes that are involved with chain elongation and desaturation of fatty acids may not be able to convert ALA effectively into the longer chain homologs of omega-3 fats and therefore suffer functional omega-3 fatty acid insufficiencies. So if there is a patient who is truly disinsulinistic and has diabetes, in those cases, then you might have to use as a therapeutic support the omega-3 EPA and DHA rather than relying upon the ALA flaxseed oil contributor. One can obviously observe this clinically by administering increased levels of these omega-3 fats and then observing the resolution of fatty acid insufficiency symptoms, dryness of the skin, various types of dermatitis, dryness of the hair, splotchy patches of depigmentation on the skin, thirst, and frequent urination, which are signs of omega-3 insufficiency. So by monitoring symptoms and supplementing then with either flaxseed oil, ALA, or then going to the EPA-DHA mixtures, one can start to see resolution of some of these fatty acid insufficiency signs and symptoms. This also, as I mentioned, correlates with improved insulin sensitivity and reduced postprandial insulin levels. We also know that vitamin C, given as a supplementary nutrient, plays a role in glucoregulation, and there was a very interesting provocative paper just published in Free Radical Medicine and Biology, volume 23, page 804, in 1997, in which ascorbate catabolism, or the breakdown of vitamin C, was investigated in human cells. As you undoubtedly know, humans, like a few animals, including the guinea pig, are unable to synthesize vitamin C from glucose, and therefore it becomes an essential nutrient because they have a defect in the enzyme L-glucanolactone oxidase, is the enzyme that controls the conversion of glucose on into what would later become ascorbic acid. What we have not studied is what happens to ascorbic acid in individuals who consume diets rich in vitamin C. And these investigators from the Department of Medicinal Chemistry in Hungary have found that part of what happens to vitamin C is it becomes oxidized and it has its own ability to be metabolized in an ascorbate lactate route in peripheral cells. And therefore, exogenous ascorbate synthesis and metabolism becomes an important part of supporting glycolysis. Well, how does that work? Well, this is reviewed in a companion paper, volume 23, page 793 in 1997 in Free Radical Biology and Medicine, in which the review of how ascorbate metabolism influences animal cells, particularly in hepatocytes, liver cells, was provided. And it's interesting that cellular metabolism of vitamin C and its interrelationship with the pentose phosphate or hexose monophosphate shunt has impact then on glycolysis and gluconeogenesis. We all know about the well-known redox coupling between vitamin C and glutathione through the hexose monophosphate shunt, where glutathione is regenerated as a consequence of a vitamin C-mediated conversion to FADH2 and NADPH, which then participates in the regeneration of glutathione. So vitamin C and glutathione are interrelated. But what may be not as important is that glycogenolysis, which is a major source of UDP glucuronic acid, determines the rate at which this pathway occurs. Based upon new observations, there's a complex metabolic regulation of interrelationship between vitamin C, the hexose monophosphate shunt activity, glutathione synthesis, and prevention of oxidative stress. What this says to us clinically is that we should be very cognizant that certain individuals who have a glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase deficiency, which, as you know, G6PD deficiency is the most commonly recognized genetic mutation in humans, these individuals may have a defect, therefore, in the hexose monophosphate shunt and be more glutathione and ascorbate sensitive than individuals who do not have this metabolic defect. There are about 300 variant forms, as I mentioned, of G6PD insufficiency. So in these cases, the balance of N-acetylcysteine and glutathione and vitamin C may become very important, particularly when aggravated by insulin resistance and dysglycemia. And so individuals may need more N-acetylcysteine in these cases to reduce oxidative stress and to regenerate glutathione and to keep the whole blood reduced glutathione at optimal levels. We also know that insulin resistance relates to progression on to type 2 diabetes mellitus and how that then interrelates with hypertension. Very significant work has been done in the interrelationship between insulin resistance and hypertension. Some very nice papers, and in fact in our plenary session at the 4th International Symposium on Functional Medicine in Aspen last May, there was a very nice session that was on the relationship of insulin resistance to hypertension and cardiovascular disease. I would urge you, if you haven't had a chance to listen to the tapes of that conference, to get a hold of that session. I think you would find it extraordinarily insightful. The father of Syndrome X, Dr. Gerald Reaven, was one of the presenters, and I thought did a very nice job, both in his lecture and later in the workshops and question-answer period, describing how the Syndrome X insulin resistance relates to hypertensive disorders. In the past, the treatment of choice for hypertension has been to use various types of antihypertensive medications. But recently, the DASH study, which is the Dietary Approach to Stop Hypertension evaluation, demonstrated that a diet utilizing fruits, vegetables, and low-fat dairy products that provides adequate calcium, magnesium, and potassium at the 75th percentile produces an antihypertensive effect comparable to that achieved with many pharmacological interventions. By the way, if you want to find a citation for that, I recommend you look at Nutrition Reviews, Volume 55, page 303 in 1997. Again, let me restate this because this might have slipped by you on the first pass. What I just said is that the DASH study, the Dietary Approach to Stop Hypertension study, demonstrated that a diet emphasizing fruits, vegetables, and low-fat dairy products providing increased intake of calcium, magnesium, and potassium produced an antihypertensive effect comparable to that achieved with many pharmacological interventions. So here is another example where dietary intervention of the right type tailored to the individual's need can have a very profound positive therapeutic benefit and improve patient outcome and reduce then the expenditures of therapy and the potential adverse side effects that occur with some of these antihypertensive medications. Let me look at another clinical manifestation of dysinsulinism and glucoregulation problems, and that is age-related macular degeneration and diabetic cataract. Recent review in Molecular Medicine Today, in volume 43, page 84, 1997, described what we are starting to learn about age-related macular degeneration, or ARMD. This is the most common cause of blindness in older age individuals, and I think it's very important to recognize once again that dietary variables appear to play a role in the loss of the fovea and detachment of the macula. And this has to do with insufficiencies of dietary intake of carotenoids, particularly the lutein family of orange or yellow type pigments. The fovea of the eye is the only tissue in the body that is stained yellow, and this is, as a consequence, presumably the deposition of the pigment lutein from our diets, which then helps to protect the structure of the macula against oxidative damage. So the fovea concentration of lutein is a very important apparent physiological protective mechanism against the photobiology of that portion of the eye, where you have the focus of light on that region with the potential photosensitization of oxidative stress. So again, increasing lutein-rich vegetables that are rich in these carotenoids is a very, very important. Well, I think we've given you quite a bit to chew on, so to speak, in this month's Functional Medicine Update, and I really once again thank Dr. Bethea for his insightful stimulation and catalyst of our thinking. And I want to wish all of you a happy holidays as we move into 1998 and what will be our 16th year of Functional Medicine Update. So have a great holiday season, and we'll visit with you in the new year.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by HealthCom International Incorporated of Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.